Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. My name is Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. And welcome back to the show, all my Bitcoiners all around the world. Thanks for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Got a great one for you today. Had a lot of fun hanging out with my boy Preston Pish. But before we get into this one, let's check in with Swan. We're doing something really cool over at Swan. We're giving away Jan Pritzker's book. He's the co-founder and CTO of Swan. It's called Inventing Bitcoin. It's, I think, one of the best introductions to the Bitcoin system. We're giving it away for free in an effort to spread Bitcoin knowledge. You can go to swanbitcoin.com/freebook to claim your copy. We have it in three different ebook formats and MP3, read by our friend Guy Swan at Bitcoin Audible. All we ask is that you pay it forward by sharing the book with at least three friends and family. And to all the Swan Force members, our referral program at Swan, we've set up a way for you to give the book away to help you recruit new Bitcoiners. So you can look in your referral dashboard, log into your Swan account, check out your referral dash, and you'll find a link that you can use to send your Swan Force landing page with a book pop-up. So use your regular Swan Force landing page and they'll get a pop-up for the free book offer. And if that person signs up for Swan anytime in the future, you'll get that referral credit. So if you're not signed up for Swan Force yet, go to swanbitcoin.com/enlist to get started. It's a great deal. You'll earn 25% of Swan's fees on their purchases for 3 years. And your referral gets 10 bucks of free BTC and a free book. All right, let's dive into this one. Preston Pish is co-founder of the Investors Podcast Network and co-host of We Study Billionaires on that network, a podcast on that network. Preston is one of my favorite guys to listen to talking about Bitcoin. He's been in the space since 2015. He's appeared 3 times on the Swan Signal podcast. This is his first appearance on Citizen Bitcoin. It was a lot of fun. He and I just hung out, talked Bitcoin for about an hour and a half. We actually listened for about 10 or 15 minutes to some awesome stories from Preston about his days in the Air Force and at West Point. And then we get into Bitcoin. We talk about MicroStrategy news, PayPal. We get really bullish. And then we take some questions from the audience. This one was broadcast live on my new YouTube channel. So you can check that out at youtube.com/citizenbitcoin. If you're not subscribed to this audio podcast, that's at citizenbitcoin.world. All right, here we go. Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining. This is, I think, maybe the third time I've done the Citizen Bitcoin podcast live. It's been audio only for 106 episodes. This is number 108. So yeah, this is the second time I think I've gone live. You know, I started doing it with Swan Signal and like, you know, might as well start playing the YouTube game. I saw how much action happens on YouTube, man. YouTube's a beast.
It is.
So I was like, I got to get Citizen Bitcoin up on that platform. So yeah, I appreciate you joining me, man. I think you doubled my subscriptions. <There's> a bunch of people watching now, and I appreciate it. Thanks for being here, guys. I'm just going to hang out with Preston tonight. This is a lot of fun. I've gotten to know Preston a little bit over the past few months. Had the pleasure and fortune to speak with him on a couple of great podcasts on Swan Signal. One with Adam Back, a couple with Andy Edstrom that were fantastic. So it's going to be fun to just kind of, go in the more hangout, chill, one-on-one vibe here on Citizen Bitcoin. So Preston, man, I've been listening to the Investors Podcast for a while. Like I said, gotten to speak with you a few times. And, you have an interesting background. And we got into this a little bit on the last Swan Signal when we were talking with Andy. And somebody in the chat asked about your flying background. And it was, lots of people were really interested. The questions started flying in. I would love to hear a little bit about your background, man. Like, how did you study engineering? Let's talk a little bit about that. Let's hear about how you got into flying and what that experience was like.
Yeah. So I went to a military school and
West Point, right?
And when you go there, you have to select a branch after you graduate. And my time there, I realized real fast that I was not cut out for infantry at all.
Okay. Why was that?
Because so the school sends you through, they do during your summer training events, they send you all over to learn all the different branches in the Army. So like I got sent to Fort Knox, we got to climb inside tanks, go drive tanks, shoot tanks. You got to go do field artillery stuff where you're shooting various munitions and things like that. We got a couple flights in helicopters.
Yeah.
We did infantry training where you're out there carrying, you know, 240 machine guns and whatnot and all the ammo associated with it. And I realized very fast that I was cut out for aviation.
just like the physical, work and stuff of like being on the ground.
I liked the challenge. Like, you know, they throw you in the field for a week and you're just out there roughing it. Like,
yeah, yeah.
I enjoyed it. I just knew I didn't want to do it for a career. Right. So there's like a difference of doing it for a week and, you know, you're there with your buddies and everyone's just, you know, beating each other up and calling each other's names and whatnot. And you just realize like, I can do this. I just don't know that I want to do this.
Yeah. Don't want to have to fight the gravity, man. Let the machine do it for you.
especially when my opportunity cost was sitting in an aircraft flying around in air conditioning.
Right. I mean, and just, I mean, obviously we're, you know, the elephant in the room here, the obvious, you know, reason to fly is just the thrill of it. Right. I mean, it's gotta be, there's gotta be, I mean, nothing like it. I would imagine. I've never flown in a jet before, obviously. But yeah. What's it like, man?
So for me personally, whenever I flew the first time, you actually shoot something off the aircraft, it's a pretty neat experience. As far as the flying part, and you don't get to that till, I mean, in flight school, you go through your flight school training and they start you off in a Bell 206, mm-hmm. real small, almost looks like a news chopper. They start you off in that and you just learn how to wiggle the sticks. And it was, you know, what's surprising to me is you go out there and literally the second day in the aircraft, your instructor takes you out there and they're like, all right, well, you're just going to have to learn how to hover somehow. So we're going to try today. Right? And when you're flying a 206, it doesn't have any type of stabilization on the tail rotor, and you work the tail rotor with your pedals. And so you got the collective in your left hand, you have a cyclic in your right hand, and it's changing the collective changes the pitch in the blades collectively. The cyclic changes the blades, depending on where they're at in the
so you got like left and right. You got both sides.
And then you're working the pedals in order to keep the nose straight. So okay. you try this for the first time. And I mean, it's the best analogy I've ever heard is it's like trying to stand on top of a basketball, you know, it's not wanting to fly itself. And so, you know, it's a fun experience to try to learn how to fly. So then when you're learning all that, you're learning all the, how to fly instruments, you're doing all these tasks just to learn how to not kill yourself in a aircraft that does not want to fly. And I tell you, that's the big thing between an airplane and a helicopter. Airplanes truly want to fly for the most part. Like you can take, if you're in a Cessna and you're up there at 1,000 feet and you pull back on the controls, on the yoke, and you let go,
it
will actually pitch and kind of want to level itself out. It wants to stay. If you got your center of gravity all kind of matched up, it'll just want to try to balance itself out. You try to do something like that in a helicopter that doesn't have some type of auto control, I mean, the thing is trying to crash itself.
And so this is all done on purpose, right? They want you to do it all manual first. It's like your dad, taking you out to a big parking lot and learning to drive a stick when that's not necessary at all anymore.
Yeah. And it's funny because the old timers, they started off on an aircraft called a TH-55, and it had a governor for the throttle. So not only were you working the collective with your left hand, but then you were adjusting your grip on that on that collective to make sure that you were applying enough throttle on the engine. So you were working a fourth control. And so, I mean, if you've never played a drum set before, working both your feet and working both your hands, like you're going to suck at it. And so the instructors let you take it right to the edge of practically crashing, and then they bring you back and you start over again, trying to learn. But it was fun. I kind of lost track of where I was going with this, but it was fun for me the first time that after you get through all of the basics of just trying to learn how to fly and not kill yourself in a helicopter to actually start shooting munitions off of it was a pretty spectacular event.
Yeah. So what's that feel like? I mean, is there like a massive kickback and you can kind of feel the machine, basically get pushed back against the munitions?
So if you're for the Apache specifically, is what I'm familiar with. If you're in the Apache and you shoot the 30mm cannon and you're in a hover, it backs up. It backs up the helicopter at a hover.
Right. Right.
It has it has that much juice.
Yeah. Man. That's wild, man. It's wild. So how would you compare that experience to the ride that we're on now? You've been on since 2015, I think. It's also wild. It's a different thing. Yeah,
it's exciting. I mean, similar to that, like you don't know for sure that you're coming back after a flight. You know, I've flown many missions in Afghanistan. You've got a pretty good feeling you're going to be coming back after the flight, but you never know. And it's very exciting. It's very exhilarating. I think we're seeing some of that right now. After the halving events, I'm of such a firm opinion that you go into seller's exhaustion is what this is. You know, so many people want to talk about how we're adopting new buyers, and pretty much all I want to talk about is how we're exhausting sellers.
Right.
And I think that's the thing that makes that makes this so neat is because, I mean, you have both aspects playing out. I'm not suggesting that the one is more important than the other, but I think that that one almost ensures the adoption of the other.
Right.
Meaning
right.
like the seller exhaustion, that the fact that you're snuffing out the sellers gets the price to such an advantageous position that it automatically brings in the buyers that are chasing the price action.
It's the number go up technology, right? You exhaust the sellers. The number has to go up as you exhaust the sellers.
It sounds like a joke when we say it, but in a weird way, it's serious.
It is. Well, that's like most Bitcoin memes. It sounds like a joke when we're saying it, but you know, when you actually look at what's behind it, the ideas behind it, it's actually serious.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's the way it works. It's programmed in. The moon is programmed. I think, Trav says that a lot, Parabolic Trav on Twitter, the moon is programmed. I mean, it's hard to deny that at this point. So what's interesting to me now is that we're seeing just, you know, month after month this year has been incredibly bullish adoption news, right? And, you know, that's really what this is about, right? It's the seller exhaustion, but then that's driving, like you said, the adoption, because the number goes up and the faith in the network and the, you know, this thing is actually real goes up. And when you get verification, validation from, you know, a MicroStrategy, a Square, a PayPal level of companies engaging in this asset, it's just snowballing. And like the dominoes are just like starting to tip over. And, you know, like when that effect starts, it's like the first few are kind of slow, but then it just builds up. It's a snowball down the mountain. I mean, this is happening. Like we've been talking about this for a long time as Bitcoiners, right? But we're seeing the corporate adoption. And, we're hearing a lot more talk about sovereign adoption, about coalitions of smaller countries kind of getting together to become a Bitcoin friendly sort of, trade collaborative, you know. It's happening, man.
You know, what's so different for me is back in the 2017 bull market, which was something that I just mentally had never experienced in financial markets ever. it was indescribable. And what we've seen on this cycle, I mean, we haven't even seen nothing like this. This baby is still asleep. It has not even woken up yet.
Right.
right? Compared to what we experienced back then in the 16-17 timeframe. So what was different for me back then was here I was going through this thing. And I mean, just murdering it on returns, like I was saying, it was indescribable. And so I would have these conversations with friends and other people,
right?
And I would explain to them why I owned this. And they are just looking at me like, you're nuts, dude. You're going to lose all that.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Like, you're going to lose all that. And what I find just so surprising right now is like this baby hasn't even woke up yet. And I'm getting calls from friends and people that I just had never even thought. And like, perfect example, I was on a call with a friend today and the person reached out and they said, Preston, I had an email from my financial advisor and they said I need to have a 5% allocation into Bitcoin and my advisor is Fidelity.
Right.
It's like, yeah, my advice to him, I says, hey, whatever your net worth is today, divide it by this number. And that's probably how many Bitcoins you probably need to own right now.
Yeah.
And he was just kind of like, oh, okay. And I mean, never did I receive any type of calls on the previous cycle like that. And this is like a daily event.
Yep. Yep. It is. So with the cycle, obviously just the sheer numbers, the volume of fiat that we need to come in to the market to, add on to the market cap of Bitcoin is obviously a lot larger, order of magnitude or so larger than it was in 2017. And I think, it's pretty much true that 2017 was retail driven, or, individual speculators or like maybe professionals, but doing it on their own time kind of thing. But when you have a company come in and buy 0.1% of all the Bitcoin, plus, GigaChad adds on another 170 mil on his personal balance sheet, right? By the way, he's up 59 million on that right now. by the way. So, I mean, but when you get these big movers coming in, like these guys can scoop up so much all at once. So I'm not like the idea that, hey, there's not going to be enough fiat to really drive a bull market this time around. So like you hear that, it's just ludicrous, right? Like these are the big players this time that are coming in.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, you got Paul Tudor Jones, man. I mean, who else do you want?
All right. Hey, well, he was on CNBC, I think it was last week, right? Yeah. And he got the Bitcoin question and he said he's more bullish on Bitcoin now.
Yeah, I know.
Than he was when he came in, and I bet he's going to buy more. To me,
I love how Andrew Ross Sorkin was the one interviewing, because Andrew's been a very skeptical of this for years now. And I mean, it's a little funny to me for him to be interviewing as many people and have such a good sense as to like that there's something systematically wrong, and for him to still not be able to see what this is. Right? Like this is right. it's mind blowing to me, but I interrupted you. What were you saying?
No, I was just going to say that I agree with you. They're falling one by one. Like these guys are out there pitching that, we've got massive investors and brilliant businessmen making the Bitcoin pitch better than I've seen it made almost by anyone. Like it's amazing. These guys are pitchmen, they're salesmen, right? Like Raoul Powell just gets out and rips an incredible thread, or drops a 50-page GMI report, or something like that. And the arguments are just right on point. These guys have picked it up and they're synthesizing everything and they're applying their, world-class salesman skills. And they're just out there pitching this thing. It's skin in the game. The flywheel goes. These guys are selling. They're selling Bitcoin. So what I loved about that interview with PTJ was, he calls out the Bitcoiners, and Saylor does this all the time too. He calls the cyber hornets, he's talking about miners, but the Bitcoiners have taken that on as sort of a badge of honor, calling themselves the cyber hornets, and PTJ said, hey, it's this global crowdsourced collective of absolute believers, brilliant technologists that are making this thing work and are bringing it to life and going to will it, into existence in the best way possible. That's to me the most bullish thing. These guys are sold on Bitcoiners, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's at the end of the day, the security that you're getting offered for the value that you're able to store is why there's just nothing that's possibly stepping up to provide some type of proof of work for the units that have been created that offer the security and the decentralization that you've got. And then more importantly, the ability to protect that through running full nodes that anybody and any person can run because it's that affordable to run your own full node. People just, anybody who has a lot of money is, or that's the forefront of their question.
Right.
Is what protects this from becoming impaired by some other protocol that everyone else is going to, that's going, everyone else could potentially move to.
Yep.
That's the fundamental. You don't think that I almost called him Chad Saylor as if that was his real name.
That's going to be his name. I think it's unavoidable at this point.
Michael Saylor. What do you think? If this dude is dropping that much money,
mm-hmm.
currency, let me correct mm-hmm. myself. If he's dropping that much currency into a new form of money, what is the question he's asking himself? How could I be wrong? How mm-hmm. could somebody undo this storage that I'm stuffing this all into?
Yep.
And I guarantee you he arrived at full nodes, right? The largest transaction that I can make per the time that it takes in order to send it, right? All those things are what he's asking. When you look at something, and I'm just going to say it, when you're looking at Ethereum and you have something that is being run on a few nodes, right? How do you have any sense that whoever's running those nodes is going to continue to enforce this protocol that you think is storing you your value?
Yeah.
Now, does that inhibit what Ethereum's trying to accomplish? I really think they're trying to accomplish something completely different. I think they've got a lot of technical.
I don't know what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, exactly. It's very confusing. They've got major fee issues based on the amount of people that are trying to do things on that protocol. I mean, you could go on and on about all the different things, but at the end of the day, the thing that Satoshi was trying to solve, and this is paramount, the thing that Satoshi's trying to solve is he's trying to peg global money. The dollar, every other fiat currency has no peg. It has nothing in which you can say, this is the fixed monetary baselines that we can perform all economic calculation by. It's just completely being debased. So that's what this sent out to solve. And he knew darn well, or she knew darn well when they created this, that the only way you can ensure that the voting rights are distributed is that you have to allow everybody to be able to run a full node. And it's just vital.
Yeah.
How anybody can think otherwise is just beyond my comprehension. It's just so obvious.
Yeah. Yeah. And Saylor does talk about this. I mean, you know, he studied everything closely. And again, he's a brilliant mind and he's an engineer as well. So I think he understood the technology very thoroughly. And he was reading about the game theory and about the economics and the philosophy that we've sort of started building around Bitcoin. But he always goes back to this idea that, hey, I don't want to hear that you're trying to change Bitcoin. I don't want it to change. Like, and this goes back to this idea of ossification that Bitcoin has been talking about for quite a while. Like, Bitcoin on the base layer has one objective, and that is to maintain decentralization, mm-hmm. right? That's it. And that's how we do it, is with node operators. And we proved that in 2017 with UASF. That, you know, a small group of rich companies, you know, relatively rich companies can't even overcome. They tried. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, they tried for a long time and, I mean, very hard. A coalition of companies, the biggest companies in the space, the biggest whales in the space came together and tried to push through a fundamental change to the protocol and didn't happen.
This thing is so battle hardened for people that have been in the space and watched what's happened. A lot of the new adopters, they don't understand how uncertain so much of that was back in 2017 when we were going through all of this. And I mean, you talk about battle hardened,
yes,
and tested to where we are today. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, the risk reward for buying Bitcoin in 2020 has never been better, right, than it has been before, because it's been so de-risked to this at this point.
Yes.
Which is why, you know, Michael Saylor and Square and all these, they can have the confidence that even though they have this like responsibility to their company, to their employees, to their shareholders, you know, to their board of directors, all of these, you know, kind of responsibilities they have, that takes a lot of confidence, right, to make that decision. Even though Michael Saylor had, you know, 70% of voting control of the company, like, that's still a big decision to put on your shoulders, right? That's a, you know, he's taken a big responsibility, and he, you know, executed it very thoroughly. You have to be able to believe that the risk is very small at this point. And the fact that you could have bought Bitcoin in 2020 at $4,000, $5,000 at that level of like low level of risk is amazing. That's insane, even at this level, right? But this year, I think, it'll never see an opportunity like this again in terms of risk reward for Bitcoin. This is
I'm excited to see if we go through another big liquidity event with the dollar and pretty much all the other fiat currencies all at the same time.
Yeah.
Which I think is a real possibility. I think that could play out. We might even be seeing it right now. I don't know. But if that would play out, I'm really interested to see how Bitcoin performs, because when it played out before, we were still on the previous cycle. Mm-hmm. And I would describe it as this symbiotic relationship between where we were really kind of at an equilibrium. I like to, you know, suggest that the stock to flow valuation of around 8,600 is what it was calculated for at the previous cycle. When we were sitting in there, I think it was more susceptible to the downside during a big liquidity crunch, you know, blow up, derivative blow up, whatever you want to refer to it as, than where you'd be right now, especially this far into the new cycle, because all that quantitative hardening that occurred on May 11th, the further you start getting away from that date into the next cycle, the harder it becomes, because you just don't have as many sellers that are there, that are offering the coins up on the open market. So I kind of suspect that if we'd go through another event, and if you saw the stock market have a plunge that was in similar drop to what we saw back in March, I don't suspect that you're definitely going to see a drop in the price. I just don't think in the Bitcoin price. I just don't think that you're going to see the massive opportunity that you had back in March like we saw. It might be half as much or whatever. Whatever it is. You better darn well believe I will be buying it, whatever it is.
Hell yeah.
And the deeper it goes, the better, as far as I'm concerned. I don't suspect we're going to get offered the same kind of deal, though.
No, I don't think so either. This past week, you know, we saw, you know, a pretty decent sell-off in the equities market, stock market, and Bitcoin was holding, you know, pretty strong. I mean, we had a dip this morning, and I tweeted out that we crashed from up 30% on the month to up 24% on the month overnight. You know, but we're caught and held steady here at 13.3 now. You know, I see this floor, you know, that these strong hands have got this Bitcoin, and you can see this floor kind of raising up. And so, like you're saying, when you have that volatility to the downside in the stock markets, that doesn't have the same floor like Bitcoin has, right? Mm-hmm. You can feel it. You can feel it kind of rising up. So I think, I think you're right. I mean, this thing decouples at some point. So let's talk about this potentially massive, you know, flood of liquidity that's going to be coming in, right? You know, a lot of macro, you know, people are predicting, you know, either way this election goes, you know, if there's going to be more money printing, maybe, you know, more if there's like a blue wave, than, you know, red hold. But let's talk about like next year. We've already got a bunch of quantitative easing. How can, like, what happens if, you know, the treasury or the government side that controls it, the fiscal controls, right? They unleash this through UBI or other methods, like, you know, infrastructure spending or something like that. What happens to equities? What happens to Bitcoin? I mean, just it all go up all at once, and then when does that end, right?
No, I don't think it's all going to go up. I think I think the companies that have a really strong moat, you know, they have a competitive advantage over the over their other companies that they're competing with. Those companies, especially if they've got large margins, all this printing is going to go into those hands. Now, if it's via QE, I think it goes in there at an even faster pace than if it's UBI. I think a lot of the UBI money that would come into the mix is going to be to pay down debt, to just handle the basic necessities, people just spending in general, because the cognitive habit that's now in place after being trained for so many years that your money gets debased is just astounding to me.
It is. It's underappreciated.
Yeah. Sure. It's crazy, that cognitive loop that has been conditioned into the minds of the masses. But if I was going to bet, you know, I'm looking at companies like Apple, Google, the obvious ones. Those are the ones that are going to just continue to have this parabolic curve, hyperinflation of asset market cap to them. Your mid-cap, small-cap businesses, the ones that are not necessities to society, they're just going to slowly erode when comparing them to those companies that have this impenetrable moat to them.
Yeah, and those, I mean, they're being used as stores of value at this point, right? I mean,
that's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what.
Yeah, so I mean
they're not debasing their shares. Yeah, I mean, like Google, they're not going to debase the number of shares outstanding that they have. They're making money.
Yeah,
they're still profitable. They got a fat margin. So you know, people might not know what the value is, but people do know that it will protect their buying power. So they're going to buy it.
Yeah,
that's pretty much how it's going to be viewed.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, that makes sense. What do you think about Saylor's ideas about the real inflation rate? Like, he was on the Hedgeye show with Keith McCullough, which, you know, just another source of fantastic memes. And he really dropped the hammer there for a little bit on his models and talking about, hey, what, you know, my favorite quote was, you know, what happens when 10 billionaires drop $1 billion, you know, into this protocol? They announce it. They say they're not ashamed of it, you know, and this thing just takes off, right? Because you know, your models don't take that into account, you know. And he was talking about the inflation rate, right? Go ahead.
So this is the key point to all of this.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of the day, all of this is coming down to, when you don't have a unit, when you don't have a tape measure to go and measure the value of something.
Sure.
Everything starts melting down. And what Saylor's really getting at with the whole CPI discussion, which I completely agree with. In fact, Lynn Alden and I had a conversation probably 3 or 4 months before he brought this up with Keith. And Lynn and I were talking about, well, how CPI is not capturing asset inflation, right?
Yes, exactly.
So what is the inflation rate if we're specifically talking about how many fiat units are being added into the system? And we both agreed back then that it's pretty much the balance sheet growth on the central bank's balance sheet, right? If their balance sheet is growing by 20% this year, which is pretty much the number, then that's your debasement rate. That's your inflation rate. Now, just because that's not showing up in the CPI gauge, which is the basket that the government entities are choosing you look at so they can continue to perform their fiscal spending,
which changes all the time, right?
That's right. Which keeps getting adjusted so that it looks small
for
their self-interest. You're getting duped. And so when you think about how valuations work, valuations are based off of a risk-free rate. So if the risk-free rate is 5%, then there's some type of premium that people will attach on top of that for the risk that's associated with that security. And then you look at you make an estimate of what the future free cash flows will be, and you use that discount rate, and then you come up with a price.
Right.
Well, if that discount rate is 0%, and you're looking around and you're saying, well, why did the cost of education go up 20% annually for the last 20 years? Or whatever the crazy number is. It's something like that.
Right.
You start saying to yourself, like, this is not, I cannot perform economic calculation at this point. And that's where Michael Saylor arrived at where he's at. He's saying, I cannot perform economic calculation on what the value of anything is right now. So he started digging deeper, and of course he came to Bitcoin, and it all made sense, because once you start using that as a unit of account in order to measure economic performance, like, everything changes.
Yeah.
And I've said this on some other shows, like, I started going back earlier this year, and I was like, let me just look at the performance of Apple. If I go back and I redenominate all their revenues for the last 10 years in Bitcoin for that moment in time, like if the price of Bitcoin was $10 back at this date, let me convert their billions of dollars of revenue into Bitcoin. And then let me do it again the next year, but I'll use the $20 or $50 price of Bitcoin compared to, and when you do that and you put it in BTC terms, you quickly realize that there's not a single company on the planet that their revenue is going up.
Right.
And for that matter, their net income, their profit is not going up.
Right.
So if you start doing that and you're saying, hold on a second, if I'm doing economic calculation in this unit and it's saying everything's going down, well, what does that tell me about this valuation that I'm looking at in, in this discounted, you know, BS CPI metric?
Right.
And I think that was probably the moment where I looked at myself. I said, this is insane. This is absolutely insane. What's going on right now. And I just can't believe I'm in total astonishment of how this is duping the brightest minds in economics and the brightest minds in finance and these people from these esteemed universities, and just how flipping clueless they are as to what in the world's taking place right now.
They've been conditioned, man. They're too close to this and too sold on these ideas. And they have a lot of skin in the game in that, you know, system being maintained as long as possible. I mean, we talk about this all the time. Like 98% of economics graduates are Keynesians or taught Keynesianism. There's no mention of, you know, hard money, sound money, Austrian economics ideas, unless you seek out the few schools who actually have, you know, hold, like, you know, professors, seats, you know, dedicated to studying Austrian economics. There's very few of them around the world. That's what this do. You know, Danielle DiMartino Booth, her fantastic book Fed Up talks about this. Like, she was in the belly of the beast, and in 2008, you know, 2007, 2008. None of them understood what was going on, even though the numbers are all right there. And she's an analyst. She's pulling them together. She was working for the Dallas Fed president, whose name escapes me, Richard something. And he was one of, if not the only person in the room when they were making decisions about how to respond to this crisis and whether or not to start QE, that dissented against that plan. And that's when she, you know,
she left knew, and I don't want to speak for Danielle, but she's the type of person who knew that this is not a solution. This is a Band-Aid.
Exactly.
This is a Band-Aid on a sucking chest wound that is a systematic failure. Cause this is why this is how I found Bitcoin, is because I lived through the 2008 crisis. I had money in the markets in 2008. If you're under the age of 35 right now, most likely you were not a market participant in the 2008 crash, right?
Right.
So if you're one of these people that have been investing and you're 35 years or younger, all you know is that the stock market goes up. That's all you know. Like these people that are following Dave Portnoy, right? Like they're following his moves. They're making money. They're not really comparing it to any other benchmark. Like if they're comparing it to QQQ, the NASDAQ, they're probably down, right? But they're thinking in nominal terms, just like everyone always does. And they're saying, I'm making tons of money listening to this guy, right? And dude, if you're under 35, all you know is that the numbers always go up in nominal terms. But for me, when I saw 2008 and I lived that painful experience, and I saw the reaction, which was QE. We're just going to print a bunch of money. We're going to buy some bonds with that. And we're going to stuff it into the market through the bond market. I'm thinking to myself, this isn't a solution. This is like some gimmick, right? This is some flipping gimmick.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, So I was in, you know, having read a bunch of different folks, particularly Ray Dalio, a lot of his stuff, I quickly came to the conclusion, like, the only way this can get solved is we have to go back onto a hard money system.
Yep.
And so then I started finding Bitcoin and starting reading up on that. And I was like, holy crap, like this is potentially the solution here back then. Now it's just, I don't want to say anything's obvious, but I don't see anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. There is no other option at this point. And you know, and money deals in absolutes. I mean, it's 10 stored one, it's a network effect, and it's, you know, it's just the most saleable good, as we've learned. Right. And so it just goes towards one unit, and that's Bitcoin is one at this point. Saylor makes his point as well. You know, it's he loves networks that have that are worth $100 billion and that are, you know, 90% more and are worth 90% of the market, basically, like Bitcoin is. And that means they dominate. And that's happened on the internet with social networks and other networks. You know, that's the winner. So Bitcoin is the winner. It's over at this point. Gold is not the solution. It's been co-opted. There's not going to be a consensus to go back onto a gold standard. Bretton Woods.
They might try. I would suspect they're going to try.
Because Safedine says in his book, right? Like that's the best bet.
Because I mean, it's those ranks are just filled with such crusty thinking.
Yeah.
And non-critical thinking out of people that, you know, they're going to try, and it's going to be, in my opinion, it's going to be humorous to watch them try, because it's going to be such a losing proposition. And the fact that you can just debase, like, okay, so we create this hard currency that, or we create this currency that's backed by gold, right? At whatever number of ounces to however many made up units we come up with. There's nothing stopping them from adjusting this money multiplier, because then you go back onto a money multiplier. We don't have one right now, but then you go back onto a money multiplier like we did after Bretton Woods. And all you do is you just keep adjusting the money multiplier and debasing the currency that way, right?
6102, right? Cut it in half, double it.
And your fiscal spending isn't changing. Look at the mindset of both parties right now. And the mindset is we need to do more stimulus. We need to just give away whatever, right? We need to spend more. We need to increase the velocity of money by spending more is right. The solution, right? And I mean, you're nuts.
Yeah.
You're nuts. And absolutely so nuts. They're going to solve nothing going back on a gold standard, because they can still, they have the pen and they have this ledger that equates to the number of ounces of gold compared to the number of fiat units or currency units that they're equating to it. And they're just going to debase it through a money multiplier, and you're no different than where you're at now. And
it might work for a decade or two, and you know, until it just, you know, gets co-opted again. And this is what Daniel is talking about, right? And then, us being astonished that all of these very smart academics can just be fooled, and business people too, you know, in finance. I mean, the entire finance industry has metastasized because of fiat money. So those guys have a lot to lose if we go back onto a hard money standard, right? You're not going to be able to, right? I mean, the games that are being played, the, you know, derivatives upon derivatives upon derivatives games just aren't going to be possible to that extent, certainly on a hard money standard. There's no clue inside these Federal Reserve banks that this is the idea, this is the win, this is the only way to go. It's going to solve the problem. MMT is the future. We've discovered this solution. We can just keep printing. The government has an endless printing press as long as the CPI, right, it doesn't go above 2%. And we can just change the CPI, it's just a shell game, man. And the fact that I this is what we were talking about this recently. I can't remember where it was, what episode it was, but you know, how aware are they? Are they becoming aware, right, at the central banks about what's going on here and that it's over?
I think you got a lot of people that know there's a systematic mess. I don't think that anyone understands the solution to the mess. And you know what? They don't need to. They really don't need to understand the solution, because at the end of the day, we can't get from where we are now to where I suspect we're all going without an incredible amount of printing. The printing is the thing that's going to grease the skids to allow that transition to take place. Because if you pull that, if you pull that liquidity and you don't provide that into the market, you're literally going to have things seize up and it's going to get nasty. So, I think that there definitely needs to be more printing. Even though I don't agree with it,
there's just no choice now, right?
There's no choice. It's the least bad of several terrible options.
Yeah.
It's the least bad of several terrible options is the only way I could describe it. So, you know, they're going to do what they do, and it really is, I wouldn't look at it as a bad thing or a good thing at this point, because the choices that were made that put us here, those ships sailed literally decades ago.
Yeah.
Whether people want to believe it or not, those ships sailed decades ago.
Yeah.
And exactly. So here we are. And what we need is we need the liquidity to get us into the new. I've equated it like this. You're in an aircraft. You had a bullet come through the engine and you're leaking oil and you're leaking fuel. And the only way you can land that aircraft is, unless you got spectacular flying skills, and I'm not implying that I do.
Like you do.
The only way you're going to land the aircraft is if you have some type of pump that's coming from a reservoir that's pumping liquidity into those streams in order to, even though you got all sorts of engine issues, you got to try to keep providing the liquidity into it so you can find somewhere to land, right?
Right.
That's kind of where, that's the situation I see that we're in.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense, man. The analogy that I was thinking of, I found this GIF this morning. So, you know, we have the money printer goes burr meme, and there's this great, you know, GIF that my friend, Sven Starfury Flames is his Twitter handle, Sven. He made this great, you know, just very simple dollars, you know, coming out of a printer, super simple, iconic, great GIF. Somebody took it and reversed it so that dollars are coming down into a shredder and putting out Bitcoin. So the USD shredder goes burr. So it's like both sides. And that's what you're talking about, right? You got to print all the money and then you got to shred it into Bitcoin. And like, that's how this transition can happen in a relatively, like, you know, I don't know, sane way. Right.
So this is, I have this literally sitting right in front of me, because I was talking to Stefan Lavera on Monday, and we were talking about some parallels back into the 1920s Germany. And so I had some things highlighted in this, and what we're talking about right now reminds me of this paragraph that's literally sitting right here in front of me. It says, people tend to think that hyperinflations are caused by central banks recklessly printing too much money, and all they need to do is stop it and turn off the printing press. If it were that easy, hyperinflations would almost never occur. Instead, inflation spirals push policymakers into circumstances where printing is the least bad of several terrible options. Just like I said.
Yeah, there you go. So is that, I mean, do you think that, you know, analogy or idea that I just expressed, it makes sense to you? You print and then you shred it into Bitcoin. But you've got to be printing in order to like sort of transition us through this. Cause if you remove the oil from the machine, it just seizes up. Yeah.
It has to. Yeah. You have to. When you think about all the businesses, cause not all the businesses are losing money. Some of them are just barely making it. Those businesses, you still obviously want to make it. Well, the only way you're going to make it is you have to continue to provide the currency into the system, because what's happening is all the currency is getting nested into market capitalization based off of the way that it's being inserted, the fact that all the people that are owning the equity where all this currency is flowing, right? So if I own a business and my business makes just a little bit of money, that capital is flowing into my business. Well, how do I reinvest those retained earnings? Well, I invest them into, and I'm a high net worth individual. How do I invest that? Well, I invest it into something that generates free cash flows. Right. I don't, only so many boats I can go out and buy to sustain the lifestyle that I live. And when you're talking about the people that are holding a majority of the wealth in the world, that's where they're at. They're not going out and spending it on things. They're buying equity with it. So all this printing, a majority of this printing is just going into market capitalization.
Yep.
Instead of into the hands of the people that need it to just sustain their livelihood. So to bridge that transition, and then what's so crazy and what's so really interesting about all this is, so let's say we're right. Let's say we warp ourselves 2 years into the future right now, and let's say people start demanding their payment for their salary in Bitcoin.
Yep.
Or they get paid in fiat and they just do an immediate conversion into Bitcoin, which with PayPal, I mean, that's, you can do that, yep, like this, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter. Yeah, you can do it with Swan. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how you're going to get paid in 2 years' time. If people were looking at this and saying, well, I've got to protect my buying power, so I'm just going to do an immediate conversion, or I'm going to tell my employer that I demand payment in this. And so then businesses are going to automatically start to make that conversion. And you know what's interesting? When I was studying some of the things that were happening in Germany, and I printed off this chart to help me whenever I was doing my interview with Stefan. When you look at this chart, right? I can't see it when I put it up there. You can see where it just goes bananas, right?
Yeah.
And so the question is what were the news headlines when it went bananas? What were the news headlines the year before it went bananas? Right? And so what I found really fascinating is when you go and do a little bit of research, the year before you just see it go nuts. The conversations that were happening in print, in their newspapers in Germany, and this was around the 1922 timeframe, is right before it just the currency completely melted down.
Yeah.
Which the conversations that were being printed and the decisions that were being made by businesses were, we can't use the Deutschmark as a unit of account anymore. We have to use some type of foreign currency. We have to start measuring things in dollars in order for us to even understand where we're at in space and time with the operations of our business.
Yeah.
And I think one of the key indicators that I would really watch for in this coming year is if you start to see headlines like that, if you start to hear CNBC interviews where people, because Michael Saylor is doing it right now. That's what he's saying. Whether people interpret it that way or not, he's basically saying my unit of account is Bitcoin, and yeah, I'm going to measure all my economic progress in Bitcoin.
He's saying very clearly he's putting the company on a Bitcoin standard. It was an intentional move. Yeah.
But he's far left of the rest of everybody else.
Yeah,
if you start hearing people like Tim Cook, you start seeing interviews on CNBC, you start seeing things on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that are implying these types of things, watch the hell out.
Yeah. Right?
All I can say is just watch the hell out.
This is, we always talk, we have price talks with every Bitcoiner, right? Shit comes up. Like, how fast is this thing going to go? Whatever. What's timing? Everyone likes to do this. And everyone has their ideas, but I am with you on the fact, this idea of escape velocity, right? Because at some point you hit, you know, the S curve of adoption, you hit that asymptote and boom, you're gone, right? That's escape velocity. Of any product has that. If you find product market fit to the point where, it just takes off. Every technology has an S curve that's been successful over the past 100 years, and it seems like we're like nearing that, the elbow of that asymptote, right? Just about to take off. Could it be this cycle? Well, everything is set up for that to happen, right? And we're watching these dominoes fall now. So once the race really sets in. I don't know what the number is. 10 public companies, right? 10 billionaire investors, 50. I don't know what the number is, but I don't think it's going to be like that many. I don't think it's need to be that high, right? I don't think it needs to be hundreds, because once you hit that 10s, 20s, 30s, like then it's a race. Everyone's like, oh fuck, like I've got to get Bitcoin. And then, you know, all right, we're going to start with 5%. Let's be responsible. Let's be conservative. Right. And then it's like, oh shit, they did 10%. Oh, shit, you know, and like, it's just, if the race is on and everyone sees that there's a limited number here, and the blockchain is like the most, you know, it's limited real estate, and you got to go stake your claim, you know, at that point, boom, it's like game over.
I can tell you, if Apple or Google or Amazon stepped in and took a 5% position of whatever their marketable securities are on their balance sheet, if they did that, I think the narrative changes so drastically and so fast that, and no offense to Michael Saylor, but it's just not a company that a lot of people are tracking.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he's not a billionaire that a lot of people are familiar with.
Yep.
And so when you, if you get that one company that even starts talking about this, watch out.
That's what I think too, man. It just doesn't, it's not going to take much and the race is on.
And one other point to this. So everyone's out there selling their trading courses and their, I can count to nine and this is, I'm going to draw these curves and pay me some type of monthly, you know, whatever. So I can give you these inside tips for trading. The risk that people, in my very humble opinion, the risk that people fail to account for at this stage in Bitcoin is the risk of a sovereign entrant and the risk of an Apple or a big brand name business taking global a position. Brand. Yeah. A global brand stacking it on their balance sheet.
Yeah.
Because if you're out and you're like trying to time the next Bart Simpson, because that's pretty much what people are trying to do right now. They're just looking at these Bart Simpsons and saying, oh, well, this one went for 30 days and it's going to drop. And then I'm going to buy it back because I'm brilliant and I'm really smart and I'm paying for this dude to draw some lines and tell me the thing that I intuitively understand. Right.
Right.
They're quad fours, you know, we're going to quad four it, right. Shooting a Gavin style.
Yep.
Dude, they're not accounting for real risk. My opinion, the real risk, and I'm talking about upside risk of not being in the market.
Yep.
I mean, you're just going to look like a fool.
Yeah. It's going to happen at some point. It's going to be green candles for days and months. And it's just going to be, that's the whole idea, the hyper Bitcoinization idea. And it makes sense that, and we have historic evidence that that's what happens with monies, right? When money changes hands, people want, it's a race to the most saleable good. And if it's clear that the most saleable good is changing, then the race happens. It goes very quickly. And, you know, we're building these on-ramps that make it pretty easy, a lot easier than it used to be.
Way easier than it used to be. My God, it's easier than it used to be.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of people in the community were bashing the PayPal announcement. Hey, I look at it like this. Should you take physical possession of your coins? Of course. Right. But I'm just happy that there's a shelter that's being built for people just to take cover. You know, going back to like my military training, like when you hear incoming indirect fire, dude, you get down in the bunker. You get there as fast as you can because you have no idea where the hell that thing's going to hit. Or if we're going to use like a hurricane analogy, you need some type of shelter to get yourself into. And whenever I look at what PayPal and Square and some of these others, what they're providing, even though you're not able to take physical possession of your coins, they are providing a shelter for a person that, because, dude, these things historically, right? I have no idea how this is going to play out, but historically, these things happen really fast.
Yes.
To the point where 3 days, if you're trying to get clearance of sending money from one thing to another, will literally feel like 10 years.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you need some type of shelter that you can quickly buckle down the hatch and get down into. And I think that's exactly what PayPal is going to offer people in the future, right? Like people need to have some place that they can take whatever cash they've got and hunker down.
Yeah. You know, so let's talk about Robinhood and PayPal's approach to Bitcoin real quick, because this is like, it's not really Bitcoin. It's really just sort of dollars denominated in Bitcoin. It's sort of it's a bet on Bitcoin. Dollar price, right? And they're not actually, or well, we don't know for sure, but it's, you can't withdraw Bitcoin, right? You can't actually like take out your Bitcoin. You can withdraw the dollar value of your Bitcoin, but you can't take out your actually control of your Bitcoin. So what do you think? Like, there was a question on Twitter about this too. Like, what risk does like rehypothecation pose to Bitcoin when, you know, there's on-ramps that are operating this way? And conversely, what risk, you know, do these operations take on, these businesses take on when they're not, you know, like fully backed or like 100%, you know, reserved with the actual asset itself when there's so much upside risk, right?
I mean, there's going to be people that learn that lesson the hard way.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we're going from a world of handouts and I'm not responsible for anything and it's everybody else's fault. And, you know, I always like to use a yin yang example, and you're going to get sucked through the hole to the other side, to the opposite polarity where everyone has to take accountability for their actions. That's the universe. And that's the world we're moving into. Right. And it's going to be a drastic transformation, because today it's the exact opposite of that. I mean, look at these triple P loans. I mean, my God, it's just here. I don't even care if you have positive free cash flows here. Yeah. Let me just sprinkle some of this fiat on you, right? Like
zombie companies everywhere, man.
Dude, it's going to be crazy. So yeah, I mean, if you don't do your homework and you don't know who's rehypothecating, and how they're managing that, I don't know what to tell you. You're just going to lose your money. It's all there is to it.
I mean, big boys seriously, yeah. I mean, that, taking that kind of risk, you know, with a lot of people's money. Like, I mean, if a bunch of people buy Bitcoin on PayPal and they're not actually buying the asset, and I mean, there's a huge move. Yeah, you can like, you know, hedge risk and stuff in the futures market and all that. I'm sure they have traders that are, you know, obviously doing that, but there's that risk where it gets away from you and, you know, you're bankrupt because you owe so much dollars, you know.
Whenever I think about what's going to be the buying power of one Bitcoin in the future, and everyone always says what they think it is in fiat terms, and that's fine. You can use that, because today, whatever $1 million means to you, Brady, you can say, well, I think it's going to be that in the future, even though that $1 million might buy you a pencil or whatever. But it's only valid for today when you're saying, I think that it's going to be whatever value. One of the reasons why I think the buying power of one Bitcoin is going to be so high, if you measured it in today's buying power fiat terms, is because so much rehypothecation of the baseline fiat units, if you want to even call them, it gets so convoluted. But you know, if you're going off of the numbers that at the start of 2020, there was supposedly like 37 trillion in the world of baseline fiat dollars, not credit, not things that were multiplied on top of that. When you look at how much of a multiplier effect is happening because of derivatives and because of rehypothecation, you're in quadrillions. That's how much of a multiplier there is.
Right.
So now if you're taking that number that we're using to pretty much value everything in the world today, and then you're smushing and cramming it down into 21 million.
Yep.
Dude, the buying power that's going to be associated with one of them things, astronomical, way higher than, I'll give you my opinion, it's way higher than $1 million in today's terms.
Way higher. Well, yeah, it has to be. Shout out to Knut Svenholm, one of my favorite Bitcoiners, author of a couple of great Bitcoin books. Last week or a couple of weeks ago, he had this great, a new meme. It's everything divided by 21 million, right? That's the value that we're looking, you know, at in the future. Everything on the planet divided by 21 million.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think about. I'm trying to find this question. I wanted to work it in, and it's a fun one. Okay, Sat Cat, you said you and your wife are going to be watching tonight. I hope you're still watching.
I saw that. That was a hilarious comment.
Right. There's a couple of, you know, like a couple of comments in here about people canceling, I don't know, either watching this with their wives or like, you know, changing plans with their wives to watch this. So I just thought it was kind of funny. There are several of those. Anyway, this comes from Sat Cat, and he's like, his wife asks, as a Bitcoiner's wife, I'm trying to get on board more. Can Preston give me a 30-second pitch on why we go a little higher? I think we just gave you an hour pitch, but let's condense it down to 30 seconds.
I saw somebody just post a comment that said, how will we know when the Fed's out of ammo?
Yeah.
And what I would tell you is the exact opposite of that. It's not when they're out of ammo, because they can print as much ammo as they want, and they're going to, they have to. For me to condense down why I think this thing is an incredible investment, I would frame it more for you like this. What if I'm right and what if I'm wrong? right? And then what is the symmetry of those two outcomes? Okay. So let's just say that I'm wrong and you take a 1% position in whatever your retained earnings are. And let's just say your net worth is $100,000 and you bought $1,000 worth of Bitcoin. Okay. And I'm wrong. You lose all of it. You still have 99% of your wealth.
Yep.
Let's say I'm right. And let's say that the number goes to, 10 trillion. And I think that's a very low number. I mean, your $1,000 turned into a whole lot. What would that be? 50X.
50X. Yeah. 50
so
grand.
So you made $50,000, $49,000.
Yeah.
So you have to decide for yourself what I would tell you is manage your risk through your position size. And this is another thing Shooter McGavin could have learned through some of his comments. And I'm talking about my buddy Keith.
Yeah.
when you're managing, because he was talking about, oh, you got to manage your risk. The volatility was doing this. How in the world can you talk about volatility without talking about the corresponding tethered relationships of the gains and losses that are associated with it over the same period of time? How? It's impossible.
Right? I don't.
It's like talking about day without mentioning that there's a night. It's the same thing. Right. Yeah. And so how do you manage that Sharpe ratio, which is extremely high when you look at that volatility and the gains and losses that are associated with it? The Sharpe ratio is extremely high, higher than anything I've ever seen. How do you manage it if there's a lot of volatility? You manage it with your position size if it makes you uncomfortable.
Yep.
It's that simple. Yep.
It's that simple.
It's that simple. Now, you know, others will come out and tell you got to trade the Bart Simpsons with your quad four, right?
I mean, if what's it going to matter? I mean, if this the asymmetric upside of this thing, and if it's going to do what we think it's going to do, you know, just like you're saying, right? What if we're right? What if we're wrong? If we're right on you know the magnitude of this thing, then what's it matter if your average entry point was like $10,000 or $12,000, right?
Yeah.
And all of the time and effort that it took to get your cost basis down from 12,000 to 10,000 with your, 55, trades every month and trying to catch, wicks and stuff like that. You got to outrun tax burdens. It's just a crazy game. And if you want to play that, fine. If that's your thing, I get it, right? You want to go and sit down and play some craps in Vegas and enjoy your life, just be a professional gambler, whatever. I get that. I understand that sort of like, that's fun for some people.
Brady, when it's going, if our projections on kind of like what it could achieve, and let's just say it's 10X, right? So let's say you take a 1% position.
Yeah.
And now you're up 100% in that position. Well, now you can double your position. And if it goes down by 50%, you're still literally break even. You haven't even lost anything, none of your principal. So that's what's so unique about this is if you dip your toe in the water and you start getting confirmation that you are right and that you are producing returns, you can add to your position and continue to ride it to these levels that we kind of suspect that this is going to go based off of the amount of supply that is being diminished, the amount of flow that's being diminished from the marketplace. And that's what's, in my humble opinion, that's the thing that gets it going. And then the price action alone is what makes people hold it even tighter and brings in all the other people. And then it kind of takes itself to the next level.
All right, guys, if you're watching on Periscope or Twitter and, on YouTube, throw some questions up for Preston, and I had a riff on. And in the meantime, there was one on Twitter here. And you've answered this before, but it's always helpful to hear you explain how the BTC price is tamper resistant on the derivatives product's end. And we've kind of been getting into this, but I think we can probably focus on it a little bit more clearly. So
I'm not an expert in this area, but I'll tell you this. When you have cash settled derivatives, and Luke Roman's the expert on this. He's really the guy that if you want to learn more about this, start pinging him on Twitter. He can teach you a whole lot.
But yes, Luke says, just the rest of this question includes Luke. He says Luke thinks that this can act as rocket fuel for both BTC and gold price to move up.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, the way I would describe cash settled derivatives is, you know, if you're a sovereign entity and you can print, and if you do want to manipulate this, or you're a big time financial institution, you want to manipulate this, you can do this because you have so much cash in order to manipulate. If you never have to settle physically, you can manipulate that with all the cash and all the fiat that you're sitting on.
Yep.
Similar to a person playing poker, and they have an unlimited buy-in, right? Like if you and I are playing poker and I suck, but I have a huge pot of money, a huge amount of fiat, and there's an unlimited buy-in, I'm probably going to win the game,
right?
Because you don't have the net worth that I would bring to that engagement with each other.
Just outlast anybody.
Yeah. I would think of it like that in those terms. Now, where I think Bitcoin poses such a unique change to this is when you think about the gold market, settling physically, especially when you're dealing with large quantities of gold bars, getting it there, the security around it, the purity test that's required upon receipt, all of those kinds of things make a cash settled derivatives market much more advantageous for people. They want to capture the movement in the price, but they don't want to have to play around with all those things because they're very cumbersome and they're very expensive to do. Well, when you're dealing with Bitcoin and it's physically settled, and I'm using quotations because how do you physically settle a private key, right?
Yes.
I mean, we all know how it's done, but it's very unique that you can take physical receipt of that in a near instantaneous way.
Yeah.
So it changes the game completely.
Yeah. Yeah. You can demand that.
You can demand it.
And
any type of resistance or friction.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's economic incentive, obviously, to demand it. Because once people start getting burned on these, you know, like products that are offering hypothecated Bitcoin in some way, shape, or form, people get burned, stories get out, you know, and you learn. And there's companies that are doing it the safer way who will help educate you, like, hey, you know, you should really actually hold your own Bitcoin. You know, and Swan does that, right? There's lots of companies that are doing that now where you actually are encouraged. You know, and Swan has like no withdrawal fees, and we have auto withdrawals. Like you confirm with one click in an email and your withdrawal to your account or to your hardware wallet or whatever your setup is. Here's a quick question from William. Where does one start in learning how to take ownership of their own BTC instead of using Coinbase, PayPal, BlockFi, et cetera? Right. So yeah,
I'm glad you brought it up because I get a lot of questions on this on Twitter, and I always ignore the question. And here's the reason why. Everyone has a different level of skill technically.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that if you get it wrong, I just do not want to be the person who said, hey, do this, secure your own keys. For my grandmother, as an example, if I was going to tell my grandmother to buy Bitcoin, I would not have her, and I wasn't there to assist her.
Yep.
The last thing I would tell her to do is take physical possession of her
Bitcoin. Sure. Yeah, of course.
So
it's going to be safer with a custodian that, you know, professional custodian that knows what they're doing. I get that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why I really avoid the question. If you are a technically savvy person, I would strongly encourage you to try to take physical possession of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really too personalized for me to just provide a general answer on that.
Yeah. We wrote up a good post on this on the Swan blog. So you can go to swanbitcoin.com/signal, SIGNAL. And just scroll down. There's a post called why and how to take control of your own private keys. Why, how, and when to take control of your own private keys, right? And the idea is, look, you've got to weigh the risks, right? Are you comfortable enough with, you know, taking the risk of you owning this or holding the asset physically yourself versus the risks of leaving that asset under the control of somebody else, right? Another company, for instance. And it's just a matter of understanding, right? And it's totally a personal, like Preston said, totally a personal decision. That article is really good though, because it like it walks through the possibilities and like how to sort of evaluate that risk in your personal life. And then the recommendation that I make most often, and it's a, I'm a customer of Casa, Unchained Capital is also really good. They make it really easy to take control of your keys. And that's getting like those services and the user experience for taking control of your own Bitcoin is just getting better and better, which is awesome because it was a pretty daunting, technically involved process for a long time. But Casa's got an app. It's $10 a month. You get a multi-sig, you know, address, wallet that, you know, you secure with one hardware wallet, the other keys on your phone. Casa controls the key as a backup. It's seedless, so you don't even have to like write down your seed phrase. You don't, that you know, 12 or 24 words, don't need it. So it's just a super, you're done in 10 minutes, set it up, and I love it. So that's where I direct a lot of people, just because it is such a great user experience, and I trust those guys. And I trust them to make a good product, right? But I don't have to trust them with my Bitcoin. I actually get to control my own Bitcoin. Drop that hardware wallet in a safety deposit box or somewhere that you think is safe, and I, you know, you're in great shape for a lot of Bitcoin, I think. You know, then they have other levels and tiers if you're, you know, a big baller. So yeah, that's one recommendation. Thanks for asking that question. I'd like to talk about that stuff because I think it's important. Here's one for you. You're a Dahlia fan. Do you think Dahlia is buying?
I have no idea. It wouldn't surprise me if he was. I just don't know. His comments in the past have really kind of surprised me, mostly because everything that he writes for me is just so obvious that this is kind of the answer. So, yeah, I've been surprised that there hasn't been some type of announcement. I kind of suspect Ray would be the type of person that would try to hide, if he was buying it, he'd probably try to hide the fact that he's buying it for as long as possible so he can keep buying as much as he can.
Yep.
So I don't know.
Yeah, because he has a big impact on people's investment decisions. A lot of people follow his ideas. So if you were to announce that he's in Bitcoin, I would imagine that would affect the market. Here's one. It's a little long, a little longer than will show up here on the screen. But Preston and Brady, would you guys consider going levered on your Bitcoin, as in loaning your Bitcoin to BlockFi or a similar company, and then buying more Bitcoin with the money they loaned you? It's a good question.
So this is a great question. I think that it all comes down to understanding to the nth degree what the rehypothecation is that's associated with the company that you're dealing with. I also think that this is probably the bigger consideration, is what percentage of your, if you decide that this is something that's right for you and you find the company that you think is aligned with the ethics and the processes that you think are required in order for this to occur, what percent of your Bitcoin that you do own do you think is the right allocation to do this with?
Right.
And if you're saying that it's all of it, I would tell you you're making a gross error in your understanding of risk. I might even go as far as saying that anything above 30% would probably be a gross error in your understanding of risk, but that really comes down to what your net worth is. Because this is really a mini max type of calculation that you have to perform in order to understand that. And this gets into the Kelly criterion and all that kind of stuff, because you're looking at something that's going to increase your return. Pretty much guaranteed. If you're saying that Bitcoin's going to go up, right, and you're saying this is going to add a return on top of that, then you're looking at it from this lens that this is going to increase whatever return you would have opposed to just holding Bitcoin by itself. So then the question becomes, what does the position size become? And this is based on percentages of being wrong as far as the person potentially losing the position. That would be how you'd be wrong or mismanaging it. And when you do those calculations and you look at those, then I would suggest that the number is probably a little bit smaller than what people might think at face value.
Okay. Yeah. I think, I have nothing to add to that. It's, you know, just you do your own research. It's what it boils down to. Check it out. And if it makes sense to you, give it a shot, see how you feel. But yeah, there are risks associated with it. And, you know, BlockFi has got those risks listed out on their website, and you can do that research, talk to customers, et cetera. All right, here's the fun one. How does Preston think MicroStrategy's business model will change over the next few decades? I've commented on this, so I have some thoughts, but Preston, let's hear what you think.
Well, I would characterize it more as, how is MicroStrategy's optionality going to change in the next few decades? For them to even, if I was Michael Saylor and I got asked this question, I would just tell you, well, I have no idea. I have no idea how it's going to change, because I don't know what opportunity costs are going to present themselves to me in 3 years from now.
Yeah.
But I can tell you one thing. If you were measuring their optionality of what it is they can do in the coming 5-10 years, it's an array that's growing. It's such a parabolic shape that you just can't even imagine. Because he's going to be able to buy whatever competitor, well, not whatever, but he's going to be able to buy a lot of competitors. He's going to be able to buy upstream, downstream. I mean, most of his company, from what I understand, is labor-based and a service-oriented. So as far as going upstream, downstream, I don't know how much opportunities there are there, but as far as competitors go, I would imagine there's quite a bit of optionality for him to go after. It's a really interesting thing when you look at his company. You know, I want to address this real fast, because I saw some comments on Twitter prior to us having the recording where people were asking about his company, his third quarter. Let me pull up the 10Q here so that I got all the numbers right. So what's really interesting about his company is if you compare the third quarter of 2019 to the third quarter of 2020, his total revenues for the third quarter a year ago were $119 million. His performance for revenues for this recent quarter that he just filed was $127 million. It went up, by $8 million ish. And I find that really interesting, especially with COVID. And when you read the report, he was talking a lot about, hey, there's all these COVID impacts, this and that. But as far as his top line is concerned, it's performing better than it was a year ago. So I think they probably put that in there just to kind of warn people that in the future, if all these businesses are getting impaired and there's a bunch of problems, then that trajectory that they're currently on, which is growth on their top line, might be worse in the future. So they probably just put it in there legally. When you look at the cost to generate those revenues, it's pretty much gone up in lockstep with the revenue. So really no change there. The thing that put them in the negative for the quarter that they had this loss was really they did a write-off. They did a digital asset impairment loss to the tune of $44 million. And so his if you look at his net income or his profits for the quarter, it was negative. And it was hilarious to me that Wall Street came in and the stock was down like 7% today, which, I mean, is just so funny to me. Yeah. And even with it being down that much, if I was Michael Saylor, I wouldn't be buying my stock back. I'd be buying more Bitcoin.
Right? Yeah. So that digital asset impairment loss is essentially that at the quarter close, the Bitcoin price was lower than at, you know, their cost basis, right?
So yeah, if he didn't, well, here, let me go back to the report. I can tell you the numbers real fast, or at least try to. So if he didn't have that write-off, right, he's coming in at a very similar number to what he produced the year before, which he produced 4.5 million. And I told you it was 9 higher than that. So so he's at like $13 million is what he would have came in with a profit. So then when you slap the 21% on top of that, he would have lost, oh my God, I hate doing public math. He would have lost
I know, right?
$2.6 million he would have had to pay out in tax. So instead of paying out $2.6 million in tax, he stacked $2.6 million worth of Bitcoin.
Got it.
Man, I don't want to sound egotistical when I say this, but for me, when I look at that and I see how the market dropped 7% today, based off of what he did.
Yeah.
I'm thinking to myself, what a bunch of idiots.
Yeah. Right? Right. Yeah. 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 Totally. I wouldn't be surprised anyway, now that they have so much skin in the game and they're, you know, operating on a Bitcoin standard. If they didn't get into, you know, some kind of Bitcoin services business, right? This is a burgeoning industry. The dude is, you know, has become an expert on it in 6 months. There's a lot of opportunity here. I mean, it's, you know, the beginning of this Bitcoin only industry. I mean,
the icing on the cake for me was after he took all this liquidity and just stuffed it into this,
he published
a guide
for
other companies to be able to do the same thing. Like, hey,
yeah,
you might want to look at this.
Yeah.
Fellas.
Right. Yeah. And hey, you know, we did a really good job with it. So, and we have the team here who knows how to do it. So why don't we just, you know, spin off a little division here, spin up a little division here on helping, you know, corporations convert their treasury to Bitcoin. I don't know. I mean, there might be some money there, to make, I would imagine in the coming years. Selling Bitcoin, I think, is a good thing to be doing for the next decade, or helping people buy it. Let's see if we have any more questions here. We can wrap things up. I mean, I think we've covered the ones I'm seeing here. I think we pretty much covered at some point. So, if you're asking questions now, these last few questions, we've, you know, rewind or listen on the podcast. I think we've addressed most of that stuff. Preston, man. I knew this would be fun. I really appreciate just this one-on-one time. It's a lot of fun.
Always fun with you, Brady.
Yeah. Good times. Thanks for joining, everyone. CitizenBitcoin.world for the audio version of the podcast. You can subscribe there. It'll drop tomorrow if you miss some of this. Obviously, it's on YouTube as well. And other than that, yeah. You can check out the other show that I host, Swan Signal Live. It's at youtube.com/SwanSignal. We pair up guests. We have great conversations about Bitcoin and economics. It's a ton of fun. So I get to do both formats. I get to do a little bit more formal hosting of a discussion between two great minds, and then a format like this where I get to participate in the discussion a little bit more. So I'm enjoying life right now, guys.
Doesn't get any
better. Doesn't get any better, man. All right. Take care, everyone. Good night. Thanks to Preston for joining me. That was a ton of fun. You can find Preston on Twitter at Preston Pish. That's at PrestonPysh. And I am Citizen Bitcoin on Bitcoin Twitter. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. And as I mentioned at the top, I'm now broadcasting live on YouTube and on Twitter. For that matter, the YouTube channel is youtube.com/citizenbitcoin. Head over there, subscribe, turn on notifications, hang out live with us. The live chat was hopping on this episode. It was a lot of fun. Thanks again to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring this episode and to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including the Citizen Bitcoin podcast in their feed. Head over to letstalkbitcoin.com and you can subscribe to that feed. There's several other Bitcoin-only podcasts. And it's, you know, just a good place to get a lot of Bitcoin content in one feed. Check out my merch shop at layer1btc.com. You can click on partners and then Citizen Bitcoin. There's lots of cool stuff there to check out. Of course, some Citizen Bitcoin branded stuff and some just general Bitcoin stuff, including some OPSEC friendly gear. If you don't want to be out there flashing your Bitcoin all over the place, there's some stuff that maybe some insiders might be able to pick up on. It's some good stuff. Check it out. And check out the podcast I've created for Swan, the Swan Signal podcast. It's an audio archive of our weekly Swan Signal Live broadcasts. You can find that at swansignalpodcast.com and youtube.com/swansignal. If you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. I love talking to you all. My DMs are open on Twitter. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.